This program is a theoretical account of the events that occurred on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937, and thereafter. Although she was declared dead in absentia on January the 5th, 1939, the Amelia Earhart disappearance case is considered by many to be unsolved. Vanished Amelia Earhart is recorded in its entirety with the Zoom H1N microphone. Get yours now at zoom-na.com. Welcome back to Atchison, Kansas, and Vanished Amelia Earhart. It's been cold out here in the Midwest, so what better way to warm up than a campfire and some good friends to share it with? In the first two parts of this journey, we've gotten to know Amelia Earhart as a little girl, spending her youth here in Atchison, before venturing out into the world with her family, and then on her own. The times were tough then, and a young Amelia Earhart had been bitten by the aviation bug, and was wading into the unknown skies to begin a career that would send shockwaves into the aviation world that are still felt to this very day. Tonight's episode is all about that career. Before we get to the shocking end that has been clouded in mystery for over eight decades, we're going to talk about Amelia's rise to a legendary status in American history. See, Amelia didn't just tap the glass ceiling when she burst onto the scene. She shattered it. Records were set, goals were achieved, a unique career was crafted, and a destiny was realized. Let's go flying. As we dive into Amelia's blossoming career, we examine how this woman looked aviation in the face and took it to new horizons. While it was relatively young, the aviation world wasn't ready for the boom that Amelia was about to lay on it. Amelia's career, though, didn't start with as much of a bang as she'd initially hoped. In order to gain some insight as to why this was, I decided to reach out to another one of my incredible friends.
For a while, there had been a number of pilots who had been interested in crossing the Atlantic, and there had been several attempts and all of them unsuccessful.
Michelle Albion wrote one of my favorite Earhart books of all time. The quotable Amelia Earhart gives the reader an inside look at the woman herself by using Amelia's own words to explain how she felt about a multitude of things, from aviation to motivation and everything in between. We get to hear Amelia's words describe her life as we read along and gain more insight than possibly any other book on the market today. As you listen to Michelle talk, be on the lookout for quotes from the icon herself. I can promise you that you'll hear something new.
There was a promoter in New York named George Putnam who was very interested in promoting a woman crossing the Atlantic. And there was a pilot who lived in Great Britain named Amy Guest who was very interested in being that first pilot, but her family was not supportive of this. Keep in mind that most pilots who made transatlantic journeys died, so they were not interested in having their relative pass away. So Palmer then was looking for someone to fulfill this, and they did a great deal of research, and they reached out to Amelia Earhart, who at the time was working in a settlement house in Boston called Denison House. And she remembered it as when she received the call and someone asked her if she wanted to cross the Atlantic or do some special flying. She thought it was a joke, and she thought they were bootleggers who were looking for someone to pass off illegal alcohol.
Did you catch that name? Michelle just dropped the name of someone whose fate was forever linked with that of Amelia Earhart. The flight that would eventually be known as Friendship had been originally ordered by Richard Byrd for his Antarctic expedition. But because the Ford Motor Company was a major sponsor, he made the decision to switch to a Ford Trimotor airplane. Bird sold the new Fokker to Donald Woodward, heir to the Jell-O Corporation, for $62,000. Yes, folks, Jell-O is that old. It was then registered to his Mechanical Science Corporation of Leroy, New York. Woodward then leased the airplane to Mrs. Frederick Edward Guest, also known as Amy Phipps, or Amy Guest, for her to cross the Atlantic Ocean by air. It was Amy who chose the name Friendship for the airplane. Mrs. Guest was a daughter of Henry Phipps Jr., an American industrialist. She was married to Captain Frederick Edward Guest, a prominent British politician, former Secretary of State, and a member of His Majesty's Most Honorable Privy Council. Amy Guest, however, was a multi-billionaire in her own right. And yes, billion with a B. Mrs. Guest was not a pilot, however, so pilots Wilmer Stoltz and Slim Gordon were hired to fly her airplane. When her family ruled out her own transoceanic journey, an American girl of the right type was selected to make the flight in her place. Enter Miss Amelia Mary Earhart, a social worker living in Boston. Although at this time, Amelia was a pilot with approximately 500 hours of flight experience under her belt, she did not serve as one of the pilots on this flight. She was, however, the aircraft commander. Instructions from Mrs. Guest's attorney, David T. Lehman, to Stoltz and Gordon, dated May the 18th, 1928, were very specific on this matter. Quote, "This is to say that an arrival at Trespassy of the tri-motor Fokker plane Friendship, if any questions of policy, procedure, personnel, or any other questions arises, the decision of Miss Amelia M. Earhart is to be final. That she is to have control of the plane out of the disposal of the services of all employees as fully as if she were the owner. And further, that on arrival of the plane in London, full control of the disposition of the plane and the time and services of employees shall be hers to the same extent until and unless the owner directs otherwise." This comes from The Sound of Wings by Mary S. Lovell, St. Martin's Press, New York, 1989, Chapter 11 on page 104.
But she had actually come to their notice because she had been interviewed by a Boston newspaper and talked about how important flying was, especially for women. So out of the blue, she's invited to New York. She sits in Palmer's office for hours and waits and gets very angry. He said later that she was as angry as a wet hen. And eventually he proposes this transatlantic journey. Most people would say, "I don't think this is a great idea," or "let me think about it." She immediately said yes. So she and a crew of two others would be flying from Newfoundland to cross the Atlantic and land in Europe. That was the goal. Of course, Lindbergh had made the flight earlier, so that was what they had hoped to do. She was not originally planned to fly the plane. It was a possibility, but not a probability. But she was supposed to be sort of in charge of the crew, and she had many, many duties. I recently saw an article where they were talking about she didn't really do anything. She was just there, and that's not true. She helped to prepare the flight. She worked with the crew. And so when they took off from Newfoundland on the Friendship, she was a valuable part of the crew. However, as they made the Atlantic flight, the weather was terrible. They had lots of equipment problems, and she did not actually fly. And so she was the first woman to cross the ocean, but not the first female pilot to pilot a plane across the ocean. And she fully acknowledged that. She said, "Stoltz did all the flying. He had to. I was just baggage, like a sack of potatoes." And said, "Someday maybe I'll try alone." She was criticized later by a woman's aviation magazine, which is what really got to her, about not being the actual pilot. And it was that disappointment of not being able to fly on that flight that propelled her to make her first transatlantic flight in 1928. After Amelia had gone across the ocean on the Friendship, she had been bothered a great deal because she received a great deal of praise. She received awards. She was praised, and she didn't really feel like she earned it. And so she felt like she wanted to do something to earn it. She said, "It was a consummation of my desire to wipe out the idea that I was just a sack of potatoes on the Friendship trip."
As Michelle just mentioned, Amelia Earhart became a superstar after the completion of the Friendship flight. While she saw it as an opportunity to use her newfound notoriety to educate the masses regarding women's ultimate place in aviation, she faced some pushback and criticism for her role in the flight. As if it was ever even a question, Amelia decided that she wanted to do the flight again. And this time, she wanted to do it on her own.
Most of the planning was done in secret. They didn't want a lot of attention because so many of these flights failed. So in 1932, in May, she takes off from Newfoundland and travels across the Atlantic. It was a frightening journey, and she had limited tools for navigation. So the original plan was to land in Paris. Then it was revised and she hoped to land in Great Britain. She landed in Northern Ireland and very nearly came close to missing the entire continent. We think of it as, you know, how hard could it be? Well, it was very difficult because they didn't have the kind of navigational tools that we have today. There was no GPS.
If Amelia was a superstar after the Friendship flight, crossing the Atlantic by herself at that time catapulted her into the stratosphere. Although she was taking on this task to prove that women belonged in aviation, she must have felt a sense of overwhelming vindication after completing such a terrifying flight.
I think there was definitely a sense of vindication, and she received Distinguished Flying Cross from Congress, the Cross of the Knight of the Legion of Honor from the French government, a gold medal from the National Geographic Society, and it kept on going on and on. And she got to meet President Hoover, of course. You would think that she would say, okay, I've accomplished everything I need to accomplish, then I'm going to stop. But of course she didn't. So in August of 32, she becomes the first woman to fly solo across the North Atlantic continent. And then she goes back. And then later on, she is going to break the record for doing it again because she's going to do it a little faster. She won the Harmon Trophy 3 years in a row. And then in 1935, she flew solo from Honolulu, Hawaii to Oakland, California. And it was funny, she was asked by a reporter why she was going from Hawaii to California and not from California to Hawaii. And she said that it's easier to hit a continent than it is to hit an island.
Remember that quote, "It's easier to hit a continent than an island." She did not know it then, but that sentence would be the foreshadowing for what we all know would be the end for Amelia Earhart.
She had decided that she wanted to end her career with a worldwide trip going all the way from one coast to all the way around the world to the other coast. And the Honolulu trip was a sort of dry run for that trip. So she flew from Honolulu to California by herself. It was the first solo flight, and she did it without a hitch.
All of these flights were leading Amelia to what would be her ultimate destiny, a trip around the world. As I was speaking with Michelle about Amelia's career, she told me something that I'd never heard before. And it also serves as a foreshadow to an aspect of her world flight that would come into play on the morning of July the 2nd, 1937.
As she was flying back, they had radio so that they could communicate. And so she was communicating with the folks in California, in Oakland. And they could hear her, but she cut out sometimes. So at one point, she said that she was tired of looking at the water. And they heard tired and only tired. And they thought that she was too fatigued and they were very worried about her landing. So when she got to California, the tarmac was covered with emergency vehicles. She said a special mental hazard was the sight of 3 fire engines and an ambulance in front of the hangar. She, of course, landed without a hitch, but the crowd surged and just came out of nowhere and ran on the runway before the propellers were stopped. And she was terrified that one of the propellers would hit someone.
What a story, right? No matter how many experts I talk with, I always wonder what their thoughts are on Amelia's ability to pilot an aircraft. After all, that was the very topic that was going to be called into question later when she's in Hawaii at Luke Field. Was Amelia Earhart really a good pilot, or was she simply good enough with an abnormal platform?
For those who think that she wasn't a very good pilot, we need to put it in perspective. Gore Vidal, the writer's father, was in charge of American Aviation. And Gore recalled as a young man sitting at the table and having all these pilots coming for dinner. And he would ask, you know, a few months later, a year later, whatever happened to so-and-so? How come we haven't seen this person? And it's because they died. Flying was extremely dangerous. And Amelia was a good pilot. She probably wasn't the best pilot. But most pilots couldn't get life insurance because their job was so dangerous. You know, you can compare it to astronauts in the 1960s. And everybody crashed. And some survived and most didn't. So it was a very dangerous profession to be in. On top of that, she spent so much time having to promote herself that she sometimes didn't get the flying time that she needed. And so male pilots usually had an advantage over female pilots because male pilots were trained mostly in the military. Female pilots didn't have that opportunity. So in order to become a pilot, she had to do 1,000 other jobs. She was a telephone operator. She was a photographer. You know, you name it, she did it. And when she became famous, she had to go all over the country constantly talking about aviation to promote herself. So was she a good pilot? Yes. Was she probably the best pilot she could have been? No, because she didn't get the time that she needed to do the training that she needed. She couldn't have done all of these flights, all of these records that she broke, had she not been an accomplished pilot.
The interesting aspect to observe here is in the circumstances. Amelia Earhart was an exceptional pilot, but was she the best? Maybe I'm a little biased. But one thing is for certain, the circumstances surrounding Amelia's career were vastly different than her peers. As the face for women in aviation, Amelia spent more time in the promotion of not only herself, but the industry and cause that she cared so much about pushing. On the last episode, Doug Westfall told us that the women of the time all supported each other, and there was no resentment between the ranks. But what about anyone else on Team Amelia at that time? Was there tension?
I think there was a great deal of resentment towards her, not because of her, but because of Putnam. Her husband, her promoter, was cutthroat, and he tried to put every other female aviator in the shade. However, when other pilots were asked about Amelia personally, they had a great relationship with her. She was a real team player, and she didn't believe that women's aviation could succeed unless women supported each other, which is why she founded the 99s. So she was individually loved, and not too many people appreciated her husband and his constant promotion of her and not promoting others.
Some people say that when you're at the top, the only direction that you can go is down. Amelia didn't believe that. Amelia believed that the sky was not only the limit, it was home. So it's not surprising that after crushing record after record, her quench to be better and push the envelope would get the better of her.
Contemplated course covers about 27,000 miles. It will be the first flight, if successful, which approximates the equator.
Amelia Earhart wanted to fly around the world, at the equator. She was always pushing herself. How did this idea come to her? Was it simply the next step in a career that had accomplished everything else? Or did Amelia Earhart want to do something so outrageous and so profound that she was willing to risk her very life to accomplish it?
When asked why she was going to do the around the world flight, she said to satisfy the ego that everyone exhibits sooner or later. She wanted to go out on top. She wanted to do something that no woman had done before. She wanted to be in the record books, and she wanted to be an example for other women. She knew that it was dangerous. She said, so I'm more or less mortgaging the future to go on, but what are futures for? She was very aware of the fact that the flight would be extremely dangerous. And she, I'm sure, also knew that as soon as she had had the crash that made the, that put off the flight when she crashed in Hawaii on her first attempt, that by going around the world from west to east, instead of going around the world from east to west, it would make her journey much more difficult because that Pacific hop was very dangerous at the time. It's actually really shocking because the minute she crashed and they got away alive, she said, if we don't burn up, I want to try again.
The ground loop incident. It's more than a crash, it's a turning point. It's at this point that everything for the world flight changes. Some people say that it's at this point that Amelia Earhart sealed the fate for herself and for Fred Noonan. Much more on the ground loop soon.
She did have heart-to-heart conversations with her husband and with several women pilots before she took off. And, you know, she knew it was dangerous and she knew that her chances of success were not good. The reason why her chances of success were not good wasn't just about the endurance that she would need for flying. It was also concerns about problems with navigation, which is why she had Noonan along. It was also potential problems with getting fuel supplies in foreign countries where their standards were different. You know, there were 1,001 things that could go wrong that had nothing to do with flying. And she knew that it was dangerous and that she knew her success was questionable. Her chances of success were questionable.
And so I ask you, would you do it? Would you take the risk, the extreme risk, of attempting a flight like this at that time with those odds stacked against you? Or did Amelia Earhart know something that we still don't know today? Did Amelia know that she wasn't going to return?
I'm sure she was afraid, but fear wouldn't change anything. So just like everybody else who was a pioneer at that time, and even today, you know, it takes that respect for fear, but that acknowledgement that you can't be motivated by fear, that that makes them do things that we all cower from even the concept of.
Still with me? We're just getting started on the world flight, I promise you. But there was a whole other aspect to Amelia Earhart's career that we haven't discussed yet. One of the most fascinating aspects of Amelia Earhart's career was the duality that it took on. With the great platform and promotional push that her business manager and eventual husband, George Putnam, would provide, Amelia Earhart became a household name. And I'm not talking about within aviation. I'm talking about straight-up iconography. Amelia Earhart endorsed dozens of products, everything from luggage to vehicles to cigarettes and beyond. Very quickly, she found herself in a career that had two sides, and those two sides were masterfully played by a woman that would become much more than a flyer. You can't discuss Amelia's aviation career without also discussing her endorsements, and for that, I knew exactly who I wanted to bring in.
She didn't really go pound the sidewalk. She, once she flew the flight of the Friendship, despite it being as a passenger, she was considered the number one person to endorse American aviation, or not just aviation, but all products in the United States. Lindbergh was there also, but Lindbergh was not one to go out of his way to promote products.
An aviation historian first, Barbara Schultz is an accomplished pilot, author, and a member of the 99s, the group that Amelia Earhart helped found. Her book, Endorsed by Earhart, How Amelia Earhart Financed Her Flying, is an intimate look at how Amelia parlayed her fame and notoriety into another fascinating aspect of her career that helped her achieve many of her aviation-related dreams. As Barbara tells it, Amelia quickly became America's sweetheart, and that translated into a burgeoning endorsement career.
In order to have Earhart as a sponsor or endorse their products, they would request her to do that. And as Chapin said in his book, on the Hudson Automobiles, it was quite a coup, and I emphasize that word, quite a coup, to get Earhart to endorse the new Hudson Terraplane automobile, because when she was there, hundreds of thousands of people literally would come out to watch the christening of a new airplane or a new automobile, a new product. That went along with also Douglas's airplane, the Douglas Dolphin. In fact, Earhart endorsed that twice, or christened it twice, once in Clover Field, which is now Santa Monica, and also at the grand opening of the New Jersey airport terminal. So she didn't really have to go out of her way to seek endorsements when she endorsed a line of luggage with the Orenstein Trunk and Luggage Company. Just by chance, she met the owner, Orenstein, at a social gathering. They had a discussion, and she said, well, that, you know, that would work. So she endorsed the line of luggage and made a little bit of money off of that, as well as participating in some of the designs and construction of the suitcases.
So, come one, come all? Barbara's words got me curious. When it comes to endorsements, did Amelia ever draw the line or turn anything down?
There were some things that she didn't think were appropriate. Putting her face on canned rabbit was not something she thought would not only give her extra money, but it wasn't something that she thought appropriate. When George Putnam brought a project to her to create a children's felt hat with a headband that said Amelia Earhart on it, she also turned that down because she didn't want to misuse her image to influence children.
I would be remiss at this point if I didn't introduce you to a man that would change Amelia's life forever. Some would argue that without this man, Amelia Earhart would not have had her iconic success. George Palmer Putnam, GP, as Amelia affectionately referred to him, saw a diamond in the rough when Amelia Earhart walked into his office in 1928, and that caused him to take her under his wing and make her the face for women in aviation. This wasn't GP's first rodeo, though. Just 5 years earlier, he helped catapult the career of someone you may have heard of by the name of Charles Lindbergh. It's safe to say that from this point, Amelia Earhart was in the best of hands.
He did serve as her manager, so all offers would go through him. And then occasionally, as some of the ones I mentioned, he would come up on his own, and she did turn those down. But opportunities in Philadelphia, they were introducing a new Packard automobile. She came out on the steps of the, I think it was a state building, and there were tens of thousands of people there. I'm sure they probably didn't care much about the Packard, but they wanted to see Amelia because she was, as I said, an American icon. And another reason was she was photogenic. Just her image alone emanated sincerity and trust. So I think that had a lot to do with it. But yes, all the endorsements or potential endorsements were handled by Putnam. One of the, I think, major endorsements was when Pitcairn autogyros were in production. You had the people that wanted to purchase them had to wait in line. Beechnut turned around because they were third in line and said, well, we'll let you fly our autogyro as long as we can put Beechnut on the side. And then that way, it's kind of a quid pro quo. You can fly the aircraft and at the same time endorse our products.
Since we're sitting around a campfire, let me tell you a story. It may be my favorite Earhart story of all time. An autogyro was a very expensive piece of equipment in 1930, approximately $15,000 back then. And only those people with the financial backing or corporate sponsorship were able to afford one. From the public perspective, this new odd flying machine that was able to take off from such a small piece of real estate was truly a great human achievement. The gyroplane of 1930 was cutting-edge aviation technology. The autogyro was capable of flying at very controllable slow speeds without the risk of stalling the aircraft, and yet was about as fast as any fixed-wing aircraft of the time. On December the 19th, 1930, Amelia Earhart went on a test flight in an autogyro that would become legendary. That day, she became the first female autogyro pilot on the planet. On April the 8th, 1931, an autogyro sits on the field as Amelia looks the craft over. It has four large, fully articulating rotors of lightweight construction, with support cables on the top to keep them from drooping too much when the aircraft wasn't being flown. A sleek, rounded structure with short wings with upturned ends. As Amelia completes her checks, she surely has to think that this aircraft is made to set records. Earhart wore insulated coveralls that day, and very joyfully and confidently enters the cockpit of the autogyro. Placing her leather flyer's cap on her head and adjusting herself on the parachute, Amelia starts the engine and begins her attempt at the autogyro altitude record. Maybe it was for the press, maybe for the crowd, maybe she wanted to ensure the ship had the power she would need. Or it may have been she wasn't fully focused on the task, but Amelia fell short on her first attempt at the altitude record. However, this is Amelia Earhart we're talking about here, and failure is not an option. At this point, Amelia took her own advice when she famously said, "Women must try to do things as men have tried. When they fail, their failure must be but a challenge to others." Gathering her speed, Earhart pulled back on the stick and set the autogyro on its skyward search for the record books. As the altitude increased, the air became much thinner, which would bring the onset of hypoxia, which is a lack of oxygen to the brain. If she stayed too long at those higher altitudes, she could even black out. The April air was cool, and at that altitude, it was even colder as she watched the altimeter continue to climb. The controls would continue to lose their effectiveness in thin air, and her piloting skills would be challenged as she approached her mark. When no more could be pushed from the aircraft, Amelia pushed the stick forward after having attained the incredible altitude of 18,415 feet in a normally aspirated engine in a rotorcraft. Bringing the aircraft in to a nice landing and rolling stop, Amelia entered the record books in one of the greatest aviation feats of all time. What was it about this woman, this seemingly shy woman that changed the face of aviation forever? What did people see in Amelia Earhart that caused them to flock to her like a moth to the flame?
I've often thought about that and putting myself back in that time period when, in the 1920s, that women were given much, much more freedom. Dressing was wild. Their dancing was crazy. They were drinking. And here comes Amelia Earhart, this very quiet woman who, as a passenger, had the courage to get in an aircraft, unproven, and fly across the Atlantic. I think she stood out as a representative of the modern woman, what many housewives, or not just housewives, all women aspire to, is to be courageous and do something to prove their self-worth as an individual. Because I don't think, well, just looking at the 29 Derby, our first national air race for women, that was considered by the general public as sort of a carnival act. If these women could fly, then anybody could transport or pilot an aircraft. So I think the emphasis was on, this was a woman that we aspire to be. She's done more than we could ever dream of in our lifetime. And by seeing her and being around her, hearing her lectures, I think that gave them, being part of that whole experience, because most of the speeches that she gave were attended by women. I think it's akin to people that are sports advocates now. If they have a chance to meet one of their heroes, then they've shared a little bit in that hero's experiences.
Amelia Earhart was a worldwide icon. She didn't just belong to aviation, she transcended it. A modern-day superhero, people would flock to wherever Amelia might be just to be able to say that they caught a glimpse of her, and if they were lucky enough, maybe even speak with her or get an autograph. We know this to be true because we continually hear stories at Chasing Earhart of people whose relatives had what we like to call an Earhart experience, and still talk about how that experience affected them to this very day. As her career took off to new heights, Amelia Earhart had to quickly adapt and navigate a brand new spotlight that she may not have expected to be part of the equation when she started flying. Like everything else, though, Amelia took it in stride.
Earhart didn't shun being in the limelight because, for her, it was another way to promote aviation. as a woman, be as friendly as possible and connect with all the other ladies. When she came back from the solo flight from Hawaii to Oakland, and she got out of her airplane, and she was been in the air, I don't know how long, but she was exhausted, but she took time to succinctly answer the newspaper people's questions. So I think that she probably would have appreciated being able to go sit down in the terminal on a couch and relax. But no, I think it was all about promoting aviation. She would take time to do that. And that's why she did two or three lectures a day sometimes, depending on how close they were in proximity and if she could get a ride on a airline to go to the next one. I mean, she worked really, really hard to get out there to promote aviation. I think in 1935, she made something like $40,000, and that's a lot of money. And that's just on her lectures.
Just in case you're wondering, $40,000 a year during that time is a little over $500,000 today. But it wasn't all about the money. Amelia valued this part of her life perhaps more than anything else. It gave her the platform to directly influence women, and she was not going to let that opportunity pass her by. Like everything else in her life, Amelia was presented with an opportunity, and she took that opportunity to a place that was surprising at the time, but maybe not that surprising in hindsight. She took it to college.
It was a venue where she could share the knowledge that she had as an aviator. She could share the process of flying. Perhaps some of her experiences that she had that maybe not have been quite successful. So, yeah, I think that would have been a practical career for her when she came back, and she would have embraced that. Giving lectures is about sharing your passion and sharing your experiences with other people. If you look at her record flights, those are great, but then, you know, the next week or the next month, somebody broke those records. But her ability to connect one-on-one with individuals with her lectures and also at Purdue took her out of that perspective of being an aloof heroine. And I don't think she was actually comfortable with that role. So by doing the lectures, she could show that she was just like anybody else and just had gone out and done a little bit more. And anybody could do what she could do. I don't think she relished being in a role of the American icon or the heroine for other women. I think she wanted to show that she was just like everybody else. And I think that was very important to her, that what she did, other women could do. It wasn't a monumental task.
Amelia's connection to Purdue was an important one. So important, in fact, that we're going to dedicate an entire episode of our forthcoming documentary to it. And this show will also have an entire episode dedicated to it as well. Much, much more about Purdue coming soon. There is a question that I have been wondering about for a very long time. And it's a question that may be controversial to ask, but I think presenting this question allows us to look at the whole thing from another angle. I wonder about Louise Thaden, Ruth Elder, Florence Klingensmith, Poncho Barnes, and all the others that were flying at that day. And I wonder if they were in the same position as Amelia Earhart with the backing she had, would they have been as successful? And would they have had the same level of impact? If you take Amelia Earhart the woman out of the picture and drop in anyone else from that era, take your pick. Do we have a difference? Or was Amelia Earhart truly one of a kind?
Well, I think there were a lot of aviatrixes that were as photogenic and as charming. But if you put Louise Thaden in there and she accomplished everything that Earhart did, I think there would be some increment of less popularity. I think part of Earhart's popularity had to do with the fact that she resembled Lindbergh. And Lindbergh was the one that kicked off the big craze in aviation. So here we have Lady Lindy, and she fit that bill. She was the female counterpart for Charles Lindbergh. And you didn't get any greater in the United or in world history in aviation than Charles Lindbergh. So now you have Amelia Earhart that resembles Lindbergh, and I think that's part of why she was selected. And we have the Lady Lindy and Lucky Lindy. Maybe Thaden would have been more recognizable had she done some of the accomplishments, not to the degree that Earhart did, just on the basis of what we were just talking about, her resemblance to Lindbergh.
So, it was Amelia. It was always going to be Amelia Earhart. Was it her destiny to go down in history as the greatest female pilot of all time, the best to ever do it? Perhaps it was. But while it was all fame, glory, and admiration, would that come with a deadly price? Was part of Amelia's story forever linked with an ending that has become so controversial that it's debated to this very day? Is it really surprising that Amelia Earhart, America's sweetheart, would become a polarizing figure in her mysterious vanishing over the Pacific Ocean? A question better served for another day. That's going to do it for this episode of Vanished Amelia Earhart. I want to thank Michelle Albion and Barbara Schultz for joining me tonight. Links to their work in the show notes for tonight's episode. I want to also thank everyone for continuing this dive with me. Our journey thus far has taken us from the streets of Atchison, Kansas, to Canada after World War I, to the skies, and to the record books. And we're just getting started. I think I've told enough stories for one night. See you next time.
This is Angel.
And Nikki.
From the Color Me Dead podcast. Thank you for listening to this episode of Vanished, Amelia Earhart. We hope you've enjoyed the show. Please visit us on social media, where our team posts all of our episodes as they air, news and show information and more. Go to facebook.com/vanishedAmeliaEarhart and on Twitter and Instagram, search for the handle @vanishedAE. Reviews are crucial to the show. If you enjoyed this episode, please head to iTunes to rate us and leave a review. It really helps get the word out. Vanished, Amelia Earhart is produced by Vanessa Williamson and edited by Chris Williamson. Podcast music is provided by Dane Jarris Schmid. The opinions on Vanished, Amelia Earhart are those of individual guests and may not reflect those of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. Chris Evan Films Incorporated is not affiliated with the films or clips referred to herein.
All movie clips and audio used in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of historical education and no infringement is intended. Vanished Amelia Earhart is an exclusive trademark of Chris Evan Films Incorporated and may not be used without the express written consent of Chris Evan Films Incorporated. All rights reserved. Vanished Amelia Earhart is a Chris Evan Films production. Copyright 2019. All rights reserved.